I'm glad you're here. There we go. It's a little bit better. Yeah, you guys thought you were going to get out of 25 minutes of Josh, but there it is. They always pull through. It's really, really good to see you. This morning, we are starting a new series. We finished our series on Philippians, and we're going to be starting a series that's sort of going to be broken up by some other people getting up here to speak towards the end of August for a couple weeks, and then we'll pick back up. So we'll probably be on this study probably through at least mid-August, maybe even to the end of August. But for the next few weeks and into August, what we're going to be doing is studying the way that Jesus interacts with people, the way that Jesus interacts with people. In my job, because of my job, and you've heard me talk about this before, and because of where I go to school and my major, religious studies, what I have found, especially over the last 5 years, is that I have the privilege of being able to talk to a lot of people who don't believe in God. A lot of people who either never believed in God, who were never on board with Christianity, or more often than not, people who grew up in very Christian households and then who left the faith, either when they got to high school or when they got to college. And typically, the people that you talk to who fall into this category, they're very thoughtful people. You talk to them, and you can tell that they've thought a lot about these decisions that they've made, and a lot about the beliefs that they have. And what I found that's interesting over a lot of the conversations that I've had with people who are in this category is that, first of all, a lot of them don't seem to have a problem with Jesus. When you ask them about the Bible, a lot of them will point to things in the Old Testament that that are a little bit unsavory, or things that that they're not quite grasping the context of, or they'll come up with like historical problems, or they'll come up with things in between the end of the writing of the Bible to now, you know, things, you know, in like medieval Christianity and like, you know, beliefs that sort of surface right after Christianity sort of becomes the Roman Empire in like 300 or so AD. So first of all, not a lot of people will say like, you know, I really just don't like this Jesus guy. It just never really comes up. And another thing that that I've noticed time and time and again, almost with everybody that I've talked to, is that sort of universally, all of them seem to have bad experiences with Christians. Bad experiences with Christians. And this is something that we're probably not, that is not a foreign concept to us. I should have looked this up before I came up here, but I think it was Gandhi that said, I like your Christ, but I don't like your Christians, right? And we know if you grow up in a church, you interact with people, and you'll know that church hurts are the ones that hurt the most. And I'm sure all of us can think back to a time in our life when we've been really, really hurt by somebody, either in this room that we go to church with or that we used to go to church with. But that's a problem. And so I think holding these two things together, I think one thing that we can maybe come to the conclusion of is that we can look to the way that Jesus interacts with people and first of all be sort of healed by that, be healed by the interactions that Jesus has with people just in watching them, but also that as we watch Jesus interact with people, we can learn about how to interact with people in our world, and it would be good if we did so. And so what I'd like to do this morning is I'm just going to tell you a story. I'm going to tell you a story from John chapter 4, and then we're just going to walk through it together. And I hope this will be a familiar story, but I hope that this will be as meaningful and maybe life-changing as it has been for me. John chapter 4, we're going to read a good sizable section here, and this story will be familiar to you. Beginning in verse 1, Now, when Jesus learned that the Pharisees had heard that Jesus was making and baptizing more disciples than John, although Jesus himself did not baptize, but only his disciples, he left Judea and departed again for Galilee, and he had to pass through Samaria. So he came to a town in Samaria called Sychar, near the field that Jacob had given to his son Joseph. Jacob's well was there. And so Jesus, wearied as he was from his journey, was sitting beside the well, and it was about the sixth hour, or about noon. And a woman from Samaria came to draw water, and Jesus said to her, "Give me a drink." For his disciples had gone away into the city to buy food. And the Samaritan woman said to him, "How is it that you, a Jew, ask for a drink from me, a woman of Samaria?" For Jews had no dealings with Samaritans. And Jesus answered her, "If you knew the gift of God and who it was that is saying to you, 'Give me a drink,' you would have asked him, and he would have given you living water." And the woman said to him, "Sir, you have nothing to draw water with, and the well is deep. Where do you get that living water? Are you greater than our father Jacob? He gave us this well to drink from himself, as did his and drank from it himself, as did his sons and his livestock." And Jesus said to her, "Everyone who drinks from this water will be thirsty again. The water that I will give him, but whoever drinks of the water that I will give him will never be thirsty again. The water that I will give him will become in him a spring of water welling up to eternal life." And the woman said to him, "Sir, give me this water so that I will not be thirsty or have to come here to draw water." And Jesus said to her, "Go call your husband and come here." And the woman answered him and said, "I have no husband." And Jesus said to her, "You're right in saying, 'I have no husband,' for you have had five husbands, and the one whom you now have is not your husband. What you have said is true." And the woman said to him, "Sir, I perceive that you are a prophet. Our fathers worshipped on this mountain, but you say that in Jerusalem, that's the place where we ought to worship." And Jesus said to her, "Woman, believe me, the hour is coming when neither on this mountain nor in Jerusalem will you worship the Father. You worship what you know. We worship what we know, for salvation comes from the Jews. Or you worship what you do not know. We worship what we know. But the hour is coming and is now here when the true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and in truth. For the Father is seeking such people to worship him. God is spirit, and those who worship him must worship in spirit and in truth." And the woman said to him, "I know that the Messiah is coming, he who is called Christ. And when he comes, he will tell us many things." And Jesus said to her, "I who speak to you am he." Just then his disciples came back, and they marveled that he was speaking with a woman. But no one said, "What do you seek?" or "Why are you talking with her?" So the woman left her water jar and went away into the town and said to the people, "Come see a man who told me all that I ever did. Can this be the Christ?" They went out of the town and were coming to him. Meanwhile, the disciples were urging him, saying, "Rabbi, eat." But he said to them, and this is just classic Jesus, he said to them, "I have food to eat that you do not know about." So the Jesus said to one another, "Has someone else brought him something to eat?" And Jesus said to him, "My food is to do the will of him who sent me and to accomplish his work. Do you not say there are 4 months and then comes the harvest? Look, I tell you, lift up your eyes and see that the fields are white for the harvest. Already the one who weeps is receiving his wages and gathering fruit for eternal life, so that the sower and the reaper may rejoice together. For here the saying holds true, one sows and another reaps. I sent you to reap that for which you did not labor. Others have labored, and you have entered into their labor." And many Samaritans from the town believed in him because of the woman's testimony. "He told me all that I ever did." So when the Samaritans came to him, they asked him to stay with them, and he stayed there 2 more days, and many more believed because of his word. And they said to the woman, "It is no longer because of what you said that we believe, for we have heard for ourselves, and we know that this is indeed the Savior of the world." Right, that's a good, good chunk of text there, and I should have brought my reading glasses so I didn't skip lines. But this is a story that, especially over the last few months, has grown to mean quite a lot to me. It's one of those that you hear a lot growing up, and then you really dig into it, and there's a lot going on here. And so I'd like to just walk us through that. What can we learn? First of all, Jesus, in this moment, defies social convention in order to start a conversation with this woman. I want you to think for a second. In the last 6 months, or maybe we won't set a time, when was the last time you had a conversation with somebody in an elevator? Anybody? Conversation in an elevator? No, it never happens, right? Okay, one? Yeah, no, okay, multiple? Good. So everybody knows elevator etiquette. You get in the elevator, you press your button, and then you stand as far away from everybody as possible. You get in your corner where it's safe, and you look straight ahead, and you don't say a word. And then it gets to your floor, and you walk out, and the interaction's over, no matter how many people are there. Has anybody used a person checkout like recently? You know, like not the self-checkout ones, but the people? Do you typically like it when people start having conversations with you as you're checking out? You might. I don't. When I'm checking out, like I don't know why. So at Harder House in Stratford, like I'm putting my food on the conveyor belt thing, and I'm just hoping that the person that's checking me out doesn't say, like, so, macaroni, huh? You know, like, you gonna have some macaroni? It's the worst, right? We live, I think, in a world, and maybe this is just me, but we live in a world where we like privacy. We like privacy. I'm reading a book right now. I typically try to read a nonfiction and a fiction book together. But I'm reading a book right now by Carl Rogers. Does anybody know who Carl Rogers is? Okay, Carl Rogers is a very famous clinician. He's a really, really, really wonderful clinician, a clinical psychologist. He went to seminary and then kind of dropped out, and so he sort of comes from a Christian background, but anyway, he sort of ties in some of those principles, but he writes a really great book called The Way of Being, and in A Way of Being, he talks about this paradox that we have, and he's writing this, I believe, in the 70s, but he's talking about this paradox that we have right now in Western culture, where, like, on the one hand, the last thing that we ever want to do, especially, like, now in 2024, is, like, bump into somebody in public and have a conversation with them. Like, when I go to MSU, and I'm sitting in the cafeteria, and I'm sitting by myself, I put my AirPods in, and sometimes I'm not even listening to stuff. I just don't want people to come up and talk to me, right? It's a horrible thing to do. But I do, you know, we like our privacy. I want to eat by myself and everything. And then on the other hand, what we found is that we can't have privacy. We can't, like, completely divorce ourselves from interactions with people, because we find that we're missing something in here. And Carl Rogers is somebody who sort of developed the idea of, like, group therapy. And he'd do these large group therapy sessions, and he'd get people together for like a whole week, and they'd live together, and they'd, you know, they'd have these sessions, and they'd talk, and he'd say, you know, on the one hand, people really want their privacy, and on the other hand, when they show up here, and they're in these sort of group environments, people really want to be known. People really want to have, like, good, deep, meaningful conversations. People want to know one another and know that they're known. But it's sort of not, it's not the I don't know, sort of the acceptable way of doing things. And if this was happening in the 21st century, what would happen is Jesus would be sitting at the well, and he'd see the woman far off coming, and he'd sigh to himself, and he'd go, oh, man. And then he'd, like, find something for him to do, or he'd, like, plug his AirPods in or whatever so that he didn't have to do it, and he'd, like, you know, sit, you know, in a way that definitely said, like, don't talk to me. And the woman would get her water, and she would, like, go on, right? But that's not what he does. He engages in conversation. And so, for one thing, what this tells us is that as we, like, go into our world, and as we, like, go into public and into the grocery store and into wherever we're at, we need to be people who are not afraid to have conversations with people. And more than that, we need to be people who are not afraid to have conversations with people that society expects us to hate. And we'll sort of tease this out a little bit. The second reason why this is sort of interesting and almost unacceptable that Jesus is striking a conversation with this woman is that she's a Samaritan, right? We get this little comment here in verse 9. That the Jews have no dealings with Samaritans, and if you've ever wondered why that is, it's because if you remember back your Old Testament history, at one point the nation split into two, and you had the northern kingdom and you had the southern kingdom. The southern kingdom, whose capital was Jerusalem, and then the northern kingdom, whose capital was Samaria. Right? And at some point in that history, as they split apart, The northern kingdom of Israel, whose capital was Samaria, they started making alliances with all of these people to go and destroy Judah. And then eventually they got destroyed themselves, and you can still read, I believe it's in the annals of Sennacherib, the king who destroyed the northern kingdom of Israel, that when he destroyed them, he dispersed them, and the people of Israel were no more. Right? So these are not only people for the Jews who have a history of betraying them, but there are people who aren't actually Israelites, really, and there's this messiness here. But the thing to take away is that because of this person's, because of where this person comes from, the woman at the well, Jesus was expected to hate this person because the Jews had no dealings with Samaritans. Right? And instead of just, like, allowing the woman to come and get her water and doing the elevator thing and, like, you know, kind of sitting far off and allowing her to get her water and then walk away, Jesus goes out of his way to start a conversation with this person. And I think this is important for us to note because in our world right now, because we are Christians, there are people in this world who our society expects us to hate. And you know this. And it's not that we're expected to hate them or that we want to hate them or that we do hate them. But there are people who we have from our society an expectation to dislike and to not get along with. And when I go to MSU and when I'm sitting in my class with people who come from different backgrounds, who make various different life choices, right? There are people who I am expected to just like at the very most, sit in the same room with and coexist and, like, not talk to, and then, you know, we go our separate ways, right? And that's not what Jesus does here. He goes out of his way to interact with the people that other people would expect him to not like. And I think we can grow from that. I think we can take that into our lives. And I would invite us to. The second thing that Jesus does here that I think is very important is that he hears the hurts from this woman that aren't being said. Look down in verse 16, or verse 15. The woman said to him, "Sir, give me this water so that I may not be thirsty or have to come here to draw water." And Jesus said to her, "Go call your husband and come here." And the woman answered him and said, I have no husband." And Jesus said to her, "You are right in saying that I have no husband. For you have had five husbands, and the one you now have is not your husband. What you have said is true." So typically when we read the story, at least when I've read the story in the past, I see this as like a gotcha moment, right? And we hear like an oh snap, you know, when Jesus says, it's right, you know, what you said is true, that you don't have a husband because you've had five husbands, and the man you now have is not your husband. And we're like, oh man, wow, Jesus, you got her, you know. As we come to understand, as I've come to understand the way in which these marriage relationships worked in this time, what we see here is not a woman who is utterly sinful and who has made a lot of mistakes, but a woman who has probably been rejected and stepped on. So first of all, what are our options here? What kind of woman is this? First of all, let's talk about the way that divorce worked in this time. So there's really one place in the Old Testament, Deuteronomy chapter 24, in which Moses talks about divorce, and he just says this. In Deuteronomy chapter 24, beginning in verse 1, he says, "When a man takes a wife and marries her, if she finds no favor in his eyes, because he has found some indecency in her, and he writes her a certificate divorce and puts it in her hand and sends her out of his house, and she departs out of his house, and if she goes and becomes another man's wife, and the latter man hates her and writes her a certificate of divorce and puts it in her hand and sends her out, her former husband, who sent her away, may not take her again to be his wife," there in verse 4, "after she has been defiled, for this is an abomination before the Lord." And thus begins a great debate that has gone on for centuries and centuries as to what this, in verse 1, as to what this indecency is. And this was the big debate at the time, and you see this when the scribes and Pharisees approach Jesus and they ask him, you know, can a man divorce his wife for any and every reason, or is it just sexual immorality? And that's really the two ends of the spectrum that show up. And in Jesus' time, there's this big debate happening between sort of contemporary or just before rabbis, Hillel and Shammai. And Shammai is a famous rabbi who said this indecent thing that Moses is talking about is sexual immorality. It's adultery. And the only grounds for divorce in this time, he says, is adultery, sexual immorality. If your wife has an affair, then you can divorce her. And on the other end, then you have, on the other end of the spectrum, Rabbi Hillel, who says, actually, it's any and every reason, any indecency. And the things that he lists are, if you wake up someday and you decide that your wife just isn't beautiful anymore, you can write her a certificate of divorce, and you don't have to go to court. You just write your certificate of divorce, and you give it to her so that she can get remarried, and you send her out of your house, and you're not married anymore. Or if your wife burns food, then you can divorce her and send her out and send her away. Or really, if there's anything at all that you find to be a problem with her, you can send her out. And you can probably tell which one was the more popular choice among men in this time. And so from our understanding of how divorce happens in this time, and from our understanding of how of the laws of adultery, right, work, it's likely that either this is a woman who has lost somewhere between one and five husbands, who's been widowed somewhere between one and five times, or she is a woman who she's been married to somebody who sends her out for some sort of arbitrary reason, sends her out into the streets where she can't really work or have any means or own property, and so she has to quickly get remarried again, and then the second husband finds some sort of fault with her, and he just sends her out into the streets, and so then she has to get married again, and she's been going through these cycles of rejection over and over and over and over again. So that now, even the person that she lives with is unwilling to be sort of contractually obligated to her, but is allowing her to live in this man's in his house and without being married. And so this is a woman who has experienced a lot of hurt, at the very least. And the other clue as to what kind of woman this is, we get from the time in which she's showing up. First of all, she's showing up here at the well alone, and she's showing up at noon. And this is, if you've ever done anything outside at noon, you know that this is the worst possible time to get water, right, or to do anything outside. Typically, in this sort of society, women got up very early in the morning, and they went together because that was safe, and they went to the well to get water, and they'd bring their heavy jugs of water back, and they'd carry them on their heads, and they'd go back, and they'd bring them in. You'd have water for the day. But she isn't out here in the morning. She's out here at noon. She's out here in the heat of the day, and nobody else is with her, which means that this is a woman who not only has been rejected and sent out by every man in her life, but who has also been sort of rejected from the world of women. None of the women want anything to do with her. So she's alone, and she's showing up here at the well, and she's hot. And I just want you to imagine this for a second. She wakes up in the morning, right? In the cool of the day, as all of the other women like leave town, and she hears them going. And she knows that she can't go with them because none of them like her. She's been completely rejected. And so she waits in the house for the hottest part of the day when everybody else is in their homes, and she gets her heavy jar, and she goes out to the well alone, risking danger of being attacked. And she's in the heat of the day, and maybe she's feeling nauseous because you're not supposed to be walking out at noon. And all of a sudden, she's looking at the well, and in the distance, she sees Jesus. And she doesn't see him as a person, and she doesn't see him as the Son of God, but she sees a Jew. In other words, she sees one more person in her life that, because of their nationality, is not going to want to have anything to do with her at all. Is not going to want to talk to her. And she goes to the well, and she puts her jar down, and Jesus says to her, essentially, "Can I have a drink?" That's really something. And as they engage in this conversation, Jesus is quick to hear what she isn't saying. And I think as Christians, we have to be people who are willing and able to hear the hurts that people aren't telling us, right? And I think they do. I'll just read you a little portion here from this book I was telling you about by Carl Rogers. And this has really, really touched me. In two different places, he says, "There are many, many people living in private dungeons today. People who give no evidence of it whatsoever on the outside, where you have to listen very sharply to hear the faint messages from their dungeon." And in another place, he's talking about the people who listen to him and the times in his life when he's felt really listened to. And he says, "These persons who have listened to me and who I've felt heard from, heard me without judging me, without diagnosing me, appraising me, evaluating me. They've just listened and clarified and responded to me at all the levels at which I was communicating. I can testify that when you are in psychological distress and someone really hears you without passing judgment on you, without taking responsibility, trying to take responsibility for you, without trying to mold you, it feels good." That's essentially what Jesus is doing here, isn't it? He's just listening to her. He's paying attention to the context. And when she shows up, he's paying attention to the fact that she is a woman alone who's showing up at noon to get water. And of course, he has the ability to know how many husbands she has, but he's just listening for the hurts that she isn't saying. And he states them. Finally, when Jesus interacts with this woman, he talks about ultimate things. Look down in verse 20 here. Immediately, actually the beginning in verse 19, when he makes this comment about her husbands, and she notices the fact that he is, that there's something different about him, she said, "Sir, I perceive that you're a prophet. Our fathers worshipped on this mountain, but you say that in Jerusalem that this is the place where we ought to worship." And Jesus said to her, "Woman, believe me, the hour is coming when neither on this mountain nor in Jerusalem will you worship the Father. You worship what you do not know. We worship what we know, for salvation is from the Jews. But the hour is coming and is now here when the true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and in truth. For the Father is seeking such people to worship him." Immediately, when she finds that this man is a prophet, what does she want to know? She wants to know the answers to very specific questions about doctrine and about the way that people worship, right? She has a question about worship. And the interesting thing about this is that there's a correct answer for this, but that Jesus doesn't give it. After listening to this woman and realizing that she is in a place of distress, she wants to get into the weeds about very specific things about doctrine and about how to worship. And Jesus almost ignores that completely and instead focuses on sort of ultimate things. And it's not that he isn't concerned about the way that people worship, and it's not that he isn't concerned, and it's not that there isn't a right answer for this particular question, but it's that in this moment he's worried about more ultimate things. And he's pointing forward to a sort of future hope. The hour is coming and is now here when the true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and in truth. For the Father is seeking such people to worship him. He's more worried about sort of weightier matters of the law and about interacting with this person in such a way that they will come to have a deeper and richer understanding of their relationship with God, right? And the rest can follow. The rest of the questions can follow. And I just want to point out one more thing here, just about the impact. Look down in verse 39 here. Many Samaritans from the town believed in him because of the woman's testimony. He told me all that I ever did. And so when the Samaritans came to him, and they asked him to stay with him, and he stayed there 2 days. And many more believed because of his word. And they said to the woman, "It is no longer because of what you said that we believe. For we have heard for ourselves, and we know that this is indeed the Savior of the world." Very recently, I've been touched by her testimony here. "He told me all that I ever did," and the fact that he says that with joy. Because it's not such a comfortable thing to be known by somebody. It's not such a comfortable thing to sort of see everything about you, like brought up to the surface. I don't know if you've noticed, but we have like really good mirrors here in the bathrooms. Better mirrors than I have, like the Madeline and I have at our house. I don't know why. I don't know what the mirror science is behind that, but. But in this particular bathroom, I can see all of the pores on my nose in incredible clarity, which isn't always a great thing, you know. So, like, clarity is good, but sometimes it's not. And here's this woman running back to her town, and she isn't saying, "Run! There's a man out there who knows everything I've ever done. How horrible," right? Instead, what she says is, "Wow, come! You have to come see this man who's told me everything I've ever done, who knows me." And the reason for that is that Jesus meets her with knowledge of who she is and with at the same time, all acceptance and love. I'm reading a book right now, the fiction book that I'm reading, and we'll sort of kind of end here. I'm reading a book right now in which there's just recently a scene in which you have this husband and wife, and they have a very sort of strained relationship, and it's really unhealthy. And at one point, the woman finds out that the man is having an affair. He comes back to the hotel room where he's supposed to be staying in the morning, and there's his wife standing here. And the interesting thing about the scene is that the wife isn't angry, and she isn't sad, she isn't broken up. In a sense, what she says is, "I got you. I finally got you." And she goes on to say this. Let's see here. "I want you to sit in that office, which you're so proud, in those precious mills of yours, and play the hero who works 18 hours a day, the giant of industry who keeps the whole country going, the genius who is above the common herd of winning, of whining, lying, chiseling humanity. And then I want you to come home and face the only person who knows you for what you really are, who knows the actual value of your word, of your honor, of your integrity, of your vaunted self-esteem. And I want you to face in your own home the one person who despises you and has the right to do so." Isn't that just, it's just horrible. And that's knowledge of who you are and ultimate judgment. And what with Jesus, I think we get the opposite. There's a great song by U2, A Song for Someone, I think is what it's called. It begins, "You have a face not spoiled by beauty, and I have some scars from where I've been. You have eyes that can see right through me, and you're not afraid of anything they've seen." That's the difference here. In Jesus, we see, in addition to everything that we see here, the fact that he's able and willing and motivated to speak to the people who he should have every reason and who everybody expects him to hate. And in addition to the fact that he listens to people and the hurts that they're not saying, in addition to all of those things, he is somebody who sees us for who we are and who also meets us at the same time with that knowledge, with the love and acceptance that makes us want to come to him, that makes us able to bear our own faults. And I think that's really special. If you want to have a relationship with that Lord this morning, we invite you to start that by coming by while we stand and sing.